Steve, thank you very much. Thank you, as always, for making this possible. I'm also going to thank Reem in absentia for her work in taking care of the logistics. This is, as Steve said, a new approach to business ethics for us. We've been doing, within the Beit Midrash, we've been doing business ethics series in Toronto now for, this is our seventh year, in various places, in various venues. But this is the first time we're trying what we called on the flyer business ethics from the bookshelf, to take short stories, plays, and discuss the either halachic or ethical issues, or both, which come up within the context of those stories. It was a lot of fun finding the stories with which to do this. If this goes well, I look forward to revisiting this approach in the future. Let me know. As always, I'm recording audio. I expect to upload it and then to email you the link for the audio so that you'll be able to get that. And I will ask you at that point for feedback on the format, too. The story for today is indeed Gift of the... I'm actually not sure. Is it Magi or Magi? I missed that in Sunday school, so I couldn't tell you. But it's a relatively popular story, I think. It's certainly one that I heard growing up. Interestingly, it's one of those stories that is so popular that it gets plagiarized without necessarily being acknowledged. There's a popular series for kids called Kids Speak, and it's supposed to be kids telling stories which have nice lessons to them from their own experience. And I was discussing this particular story with my kids, and one of them said, "Oh yeah, that was in Kids Speak." And yeah, it may have been, but I don't think it was a kid describing her own experience. In any case, the story is written by O. Henry. I think it's roughly 100 years ago. I did not reproduce the story on your sheets because it's simply too long for that. I did give you a link at the top and some of the story there. I'm going to read out parts of it just to refresh people's memory. You see the part that I put at the top of the source sheet. It's describing a man and a woman. The woman's name is Della. The man's name is Jim. They are living paycheck to paycheck and really scrounging for everything that they have. And their holiday is coming up. It does not mean Pesach. And they want to be able to give each other gifts because that's the minhag. But they don't have the funds to be able to do so. And the story plays up their pride in who they are, despite the fact that they're not earning much, and the fact that they also want to be able to give gifts to each other. So you see what I brought you in the beginning of the sheet. She, Della, had been saving every penny she could for months, with this result, the result being that she has only $1.87. $20 a week doesn't go far. Expenses have been greater than she had calculated. They always are. Only $1.87 to buy a present for Jim. Her Jim. Many a happy hour she had spent planning for something nice for him, something fine and rare and sterling, something just a little bit near to being worthy of the honor of being owned by Jim. That's what she wants to do. But she doesn't have the means. So as the story... Sorry? Right, so it's a couple of decades later than that, but it's not enough evidently for what she wants, as you'll see. So the story continues to say, and I'm just reading excerpts from the story. Now, there were two possessions of the James Dillingham Youngs in which they both took a mighty pride. One was Jim's gold watch that had been his father's and his grandfather's. The other was Della's hair. Had the Queen of Sheba lived in the flat across the air shaft, Della would have let her hair hang out the window someday to dry just to depreciate Her Majesty's jewels and gifts. Had King Solomon been the janitor with all his treasures piled up in the basement, Jim would have pulled out his watch every time he passed just to see him pluck at his beard from envy. So Della takes great pride in this very long hair. Jim takes great pride in his gold watch. So Della says to herself, Jim has this wonderful watch, but he is sometimes embarrassed to produce the watch for people because it doesn't have a nice fob. And so she decides she wants to buy him a silver watch fob. And that's where I'm picking up within the story, where Della has decided to do what? Those who are familiar with the story? cut off her hair and sell it, which she does, and that's the part that I'm skipping. She sells her hair for $20. And then the story continues. Oh, and the next 2 hours tripped by on rosy wings. Forget the hashed metaphor. She was ransacking the stores for Jim's present. She found it at last. It surely had been made for Jim and no one else. There was no other like it in any of the stores, and she had turned all of them inside out. It was a platinum fob chain, simple and chaste in design, properly proclaiming its value by substance alone and not by meretricious ornamentation, as all good things should do. It was even worthy of the watch. As soon as she saw it, she knew that it must be Jim's. It was like him, quietness and value, the description applied to both. $21 they took from her for it, and she hurried home with the 87 cents. With that chain on his watch, Jim might be properly anxious about the time in any company. Grand as the watch was, he sometimes looked at it on the sly on account of the old leather strap that he used in place of a chain. So she is going to make her husband happy. He's going to be proud to produce his watch now because he has this platinum chain. She's very excited. However, she's nervous because she cut off her hair for this, and what's her husband going to think when he gets home? And so the story continues to describe how she's worried, what's he going to do, and he comes into the house and he has this very strange look on his face, which is described by O. Henry as not anger and not surprise and not disapproval and not horror, but she doesn't know how to read his reaction. And so the story continues, and here I put it on your sheet as well. "You've cut off your hair," asked Jim laboriously, as if he had not arrived at that patent fact yet, even after the hardest mental labor. "Cut it off and sold it," said Della. "Don't you like me just as well anyhow? I'm me without my hair, ain't I?" My spell check didn't like that. Jim looked about the room curiously. "You say your hair is gone?" he said, with an air almost of idiocy. And she continues to explain, "Yes, I sold it." And then Jim shows her why this is such a big deal. Because what has Jim done? Sold his watch in order to buy? Hair combs, exactly. Jim drew a package from his overcoat pocket and threw it upon the table. "Don't make any mistake, Dell," he said, "about me. I don't think there's anything in the way of a haircut or a shave or a shampoo that could make me like my girl any less, but if you'll unwrap that package, you may see why you had me going a while at first." And he continues, and I'm skipping a little bit. There lay the combs, the set of combs, side and back, that Della had worshipped long in a Broadway window. Beautiful combs, pure tortoise shell with jeweled rims, just the shade to wear in the beautiful vanished hair. So now they have a chain for a watch that they don't own, and combs for hair that doesn't exist.
Do they know they don't own the watch?
Yes, that's what he explains to her. "I sold it. I sold off the watch." Oh. And I mean, that's how the story plays out. And you can go online and read it. You can buy an O. Henry collection of short stories and see it there too. But I have two questions that I'd like to ask from this story. There's a lot to discuss within the story, but in terms of our timing, one is a question of halacha, of Jewish law, and the other question is more philosophical. The first question is this: if Jim wanted to reverse his sale because it was made on the basis of error, right? Della can reverse her sale. That's too late. The hair is cut off. In the 19-teens, 1920s, I don't know that they're going to be able to do anything with hair extensions or whatever it is. If Jim, though, says, "I want my watch back, the combs are useless to us," can he do that? Because his sale was made on the basis of a mistake. He assumed that he was buying the combs for his wife's hair, but his wife's hair doesn't exist anymore. Could he legitimately say, "I want to reverse the sale of my watch"? That's question number one, which I'm going to come back to and ask your opinion on in a moment. But the second question is philosophical and ethical, and that is, what can we learn from this story about altruism, about our approach to community, to other people, and the way we act? And neither of these is entirely simple. I think that there's a lot to be said. But let's go to the first question first. Reversing the sale of the watch. What do you think?
Talking about whether or not the merchant has an obligation to refund.
Correct. Jim walks into the store and says, "I'd like to buy my watch back." Or not buy my watch back, but I'd like to reverse the sale. I'm going to give you the money back, and I want my watch. Or first, I suppose, I'm going to go to the place where I bought the combs tell them I don't need the combs anymore, get a refund, and then go back and demand that I be entitled to exchange the money for my watch. What do you say?
Well, the comb, by halakha, you're saying, by halakha.
Yeah, by halakha, Jewish law. Secular law is actually fairly clear in this regard. There are implied conditions within a sale. When I sell someone an item, for example, there's a principle of implied merchantability, right? The idea that if I sell someone something, I am representing that it is the sort of thing that people normally buy when they want to buy an object like this. So if I sell somebody an air conditioner, the assumption is it's a working air conditioner, not that it's a non-working air conditioner. Or if I say, well, it'll only cool the space immediately around it and not a room, again, implied merchantability says that it's going to be a valid product for this person's purposes. And there are a few other implied conditions, but none that actually fit this. There is no such thing in the implied conditions within secular law that's going to say that there's any implication by the seller, I'm only selling this to you under the condition that you actually need the money for the purpose that you had in mind.
It's even worse because the seller sold the item in a holiday sale. He's now prejudiced to purchase the item after the holiday where he won't be able to get so many people coming in. So it's even worse.
So that's an interesting point. If you were to reverse the sale of the combs, potentially you're actually harming the person who sold them to you because it would be easier for the seller to sell gift items in holiday season. You come back on December 26th, surprise, it's the holiday we're talking about. You come back on December 26th and you give him the combs, he's going to have a very hard time selling those off until the next time people are looking for presents.
And it's Boxing Day sales.
Right. Yes. Exactly. Yes?
There's a lawyer among us here. Maybe they can help explain this. It seems to me there's a legal approach. There's something called force majeure, which can be invoked in the contract.
Yeah.
Something has happened totally beyond my control, unforeseen, and now I cannot proceed or I can't use this product.
So anyone want to speak to that? We do have a few lawyers in the room.
I'm not a lawyer, but within my practice I have patients who try this all the time. I want my money back, I want a package of treatments, and I want my money back. Now, for whatever reason, because I overspent and find my finances have changed, and now I want to affect your cash. And my question is, you know, it affects my cash flow. You know, if you have a plan, right? And everybody, so. Mm-hmm.
So that would also.
So from the perspective of the merchant, it's not so much a question of ethics, but it's also how much you're putting the financial stability of these merchants.
Right.
In question, not just the fact that they can't resell.
Right. Now, Marie's question actually has a twist to it, because what we're talking about here is a physical object that has been bought, and transferring a physical item is the way to seal a transaction within Jewish law. What you're talking about is a contract for future services, and there they could make the argument that they can back out. They may have a penalty within Jewish law. In a previous session, we talked about Misha Para, the idea that there's actually a curse upon someone who backs out on his word. That may apply, but he could still... There's more room to back out from future services than there is to back out when you're actually holding the item that you bought. I'm not saying they should back out. I'm just saying that there may be room to differentiate.
Because yes. There's been a financial transaction.
Yes. Yeah.
It's based on the policy of the store. If the store has a written policy that says this and this amount of time, you have to return it, you're fine. They have no written policy, you can't return it.
Right. So let's go a little further with it. I'll take one more and then we'll go.
Sure. Yeah. The brush is a personal product. So it's unlike the chain that you bring it, and it's a completely intact. When you bring a brush back, it will be difficult to convince somebody else to use it after supposedly it was used on another person.
That's an interesting question as well. These combs, I mean, they're not brushes, but you're right. They sit in somebody's hair, and potentially it's going to be harder for someone to sell it for that reason. It's also a good point. I also realized I didn't pass out these sign-in sheets in the beginning. Just for those who, if you got the email in advance with the source sheets, you don't need to sign in. But if you didn't, then this way I'll be able to send you the follow-up from the session, the link for the audio, and so forth. Okay. So within Jewish law, there's an important concept. The concept is umdina. Umdina is an Aramaic term. Literally, it means an evaluation. but specifically we apply it to an evaluation of a person's mindset. And even though my gut reaction at first in thinking about this was there's no way you can reverse it, there are several Talmudic cases in which people engage in sales and then, in fact, back out afterwards. And backing out is effective. If you take a look at your sheet, it's source number one. Here's one example regarding regarding a deathbed gift. Passage in the Talmud, source number one. First, the Mishnah, bedrock text of the Talmud, the verbally transmitted law, which was recorded finally in the beginning of the 3rd century Common Era. And it says the following. I'm going to read the English. I brought the Hebrew so that those who can read the Hebrew will benefit from it. If a person on his deathbed gifts all of his property to others, but leaves some minimal land, and I added it in brackets, survives, his gift stands. Okay? Meaning, you have somebody who thought he was dying, gave away everything except he kept certain things for himself. The law is, if he survives, the gift is still valid. What's the logic in saying the gift is still valid? He still has some property, but he clearly thought he might survive. Otherwise, why would he have kept it? We're assuming no heirs to support and so forth. However, if he does not leave any land and he survives, his gift does not stand. Because then clearly he gave it away thinking he was going to die, and then he found out he actually needs to support himself. So we then say the gift is reversed. On this, the Talmud expands in the Gemara and asks, whose view is this? Who contends, which sage contends, that we follow an umdana, there's that word, that we actually would rely on somebody's estimated mindset? Rav Nachman says it is Rabbi Shimon ben Manasseh. He is the author of this view because we've learned the following in his name. If a person has a son and the son goes overseas, and then he hears that his son has died, and he gives away all of his assets. He says, I have no one to support anymore, I'm giving it all away. And then his son returns. The gift stands. That's the initial view. But Rabbi Shimon ben Manasseh says, no, the gifts do not stand. It was clear that the reason why he gave it away was because he thought he had lost his son. So even though we've just said that what a person was thinking in his own mind is irrelevant, we find out here that it is relevant. However, there's a key difference between our case and the case in the Talmud here. What's the key difference between these cases? Gifts. The case we're dealing with is a sale. The Talmudic case is a gift. Keep that in mind. That's going to matter a great deal in terms of it being a gift as opposed to a sale on multiple levels, as we'll see. But that's one example. Here's a second example, number two. We actually saw this case a couple of years ago in a different context. Person sold his property. No, I'm sorry, not that case. Number three is what we've seen before. Number two, though. Person sold his property expecting to ascend to Israel. He's going to make Aliyah. He went, but he couldn't make it. He tried, it didn't work out. Rava, writing in the 4th century, said, one who ascends, you go to Israel, you intend to live there. He didn't live there, and therefore the sale doesn't stand. The sale is, in fact, reversed. He sold his house thinking he was making Aliyah. He did not succeed. He came back. He goes to the people who bought the house from him, and he says, listen, here's your money back. Out of my house. And it works. Alternatively, there's an alternative view there in the Talmud. He intends to ascend, and he did ascend, and therefore he can't back out. Meaning, it's not based on living there. He knew he was just going to make a go of it. Didn't work out. That's your problem. So there are two different conclusions here in this passage. But the first conclusion says, you can back out of the sale. Even though it's a sale and not a gift at all.
Is there a time limit?
Is there a time limit on it? Not as presented here. It would be worthy of discussion, though. In other words, what qualifies as making a go of it and living there? So there is some discussion, which we're going to come back to, which may shed a little bit of light on that. But that's your second case. Now, you could argue that even though this is a sale, there's also a unique element here, which isn't in the case of the Combs. What's the unique element here?
That's real estate.
True. Real estate is one key element, which we're going to come back to.
Based on
converging Aliyah.
encouraging Aliyah. He's doing it in order to go to Israel. Maybe we want to make it easier for people to make the attempt to go to Israel, and therefore we're going to protect him where we wouldn't protect somebody if it was sold for some other purpose. Right. Which is its own discussion of, you know, is it a mitzvah or not.
We assume this was not a clause in the sale.
Correct. If this was a clause in the sale, there's nothing else to talk about. Then we're done. Like Moshe said before about where the store has a policy on returns, also, then the discussion is moot. Number three, take a look at number three. This is the one that we've seen before. There was a famine in a city called Neherdah. The population sold its great houses, right, in order to survive. They sold off their land in order to be able to buy food. In the end, grain arrived. And Rav Nachman ruled the purchasers had to return the great houses to their owners. Even though, once again, this is a sale, and this is not about he wants to make aliyah, you could argue there's a mitzvah of survival also. Nonetheless, they are indeed, according to this, they are protected, and we will reverse the sale. It's a remarkable thing, what we're saying here. We're empowering a seller to go back to the buyer, and the buyer didn't even know at the time what was going on. Right? The buyer didn't even know. It's not like the buyer was aware of the circumstances. Right? In let's say the case of the fellow's making aliyah. He sold his house to somebody. The guy who's buying it has no idea where the seller is going. He thinks the seller is moving closer to shul. He doesn't know anything about why the seller is selling his house. The seller comes back to him 6 months later and says, actually, I was trying to go to Israel and it didn't work out. Now, I want my house back. And you're telling me that that's going to work. Where is the logic in that?
Didn't the buyers in the second story have the knowledge that everyone was arriving? I somehow remember this from previous.
Right, so there isn't necessarily knowledge that the grain is arriving, no. There was a discussion about it, but no.
The way it's written, it says that the population of Blue Rock was selling. I mean, it was a mass selling. So it's very unlikely that the people that bought didn't know that there's actually...
Good. So here we have to make an important distinction. We have to make an important distinction in this discussion, and that is between what we call an umdina, an estimate, and what's called umdina demuchach, an estimate of a person's mindset which is clear cut. Meaning, if it's not something obvious to people, then you have to state it at the time of the sale. If it's not something that everybody knows, then you do have to state it at the time of the sale. So, for example, I brought you the case in number four. I didn't bring you the story, I just brought you the one line. But the case that was before Rabbi Yoshua Heschel Charif in 17th century Poland was a case in which somebody had sold his house to pay his debt. And then his sister came with funds, and he didn't need to sell the house. And Rabbi Charif rules that you had to tell the person who was buying it at the time that these are the circumstances. And you have to tell him personally. You can't just tell a broker. Like, you have to tell the actual buyer. The buyer does have to know. However, there's an exception to that rule. The exception to that rule is where it's what we call an obvious umdina, umdina demuchach. If it's something that everybody knows is clearly the reason why you are selling, then you can back out even if you did not say that to him at the time. And that's seen in source number 5 from Menachem Meiri. He says, regarding the case of the fellow's distributing his assets, thinking he's dying, even though he did not specify that he was distributing his assets because of death, we estimate that this is his mindset. And so wherever circumstances show that he only intends to give due to certain factors, we assess, based on our estimate, as though he had declared a condition. And even though we have an established principle that unstated intent, Dvarim Shebelev, is immaterial, the great French authorities have written that in 5 Talmudic cases, including the ones we mentioned, we find unstated intent is substantive. And the reason in all of the cases is because the umdina is obvious. So what we're saying is that you can back out without having notified the fellow if your mindset, the fact that you were only engaging in the sale for a particular purpose, if that was obvious to everybody.
What is the source of Torah that would say that because of what's going on in your mind, or the circumstances, but that's not known to a purchaser, that you could cause great inconvenience to the purchaser. Has no clue about the circumstances.
So it's a good question. So I would say two things. One is that this would be understood as one of the principles of sale. This is what a sale looks like. It wouldn't need a specific verse. But the other is, I'm not sure that you could actually do it if it causes inconvenience for the purchaser. I'm going to come back to that. Hang in there. It sounds like it would, but that's what I want to come back to. So, theoretically now, if it were obvious that this sale is only meant for a particular goal, then indeed, you would be able to back out. However, there are still rules governing when you can back out, and I'm going to mention two of them. Rule number one is, it can't be a normal loss. People who engage in any transaction know that they may lose. So, for example, I brought you the statement of Tosfot in source number 6. He asks, if you can really back out of deals, then every time I sell a cow, I have to worry. Someone buys the cow dies. He says, well, I didn't buy it expecting it to die. Right? Not where it was ill. It got run over by a truck, whatever it was. The Tosfot says in source number 6, commenting on this idea of backing out, he says that if anyone purchases a cow from somebody else and it becomes a trefa, gains a mortal wound, or it dies, we could testify he didn't buy it with this in mind. Right? So he says no. The number one point is that this has to be an abnormal loss, not a normal one.
So what's abnormal, the loss or the circumstances of the person who's lost?
Well, the circumstances that generated the loss.
But if we're learning this to know how it applies to our lives today, you know that we live in a world where people will play games all the time and invent and create all kinds of scenarios. And in my experience, the patients that I have or students who try to pull this on me are ones who have a history of overspending.
Mm.
Right? So they wanted everything in sight, and now they want their money back. So it's not always genuine misfortune.
That may be true. Well, we have to
investigate.
So you have to distinguish between two issues. One is, what is the law? And the other is, how is it implemented? Meaning, if the law says where the loss is abnormal, and where it was a clear-cut umdana, we know what the mindset was and everybody knew at the time, then the law will be, yeah, he can back out. However, when it comes to somebody demanding their money back, it's your right to go to a Beit Din, to go to a court and say, you know, can you investigate and find out, was this honest or not? And call testimony and look into it. But that's all on the implementation side. The question first is, what is the law before we get into how are you going to carry it out?
And you're talking about huge transactions like purchase of property.
Yep.
That where it's worth the time to do this huge event.
Right. And that will take me further with the comment of Rabbi Yaakov Lorberbaum, the Nesivos, in source number 7. In which he says, you can only back out where there was no benefit at all. Where there was no benefit at all. In other words, the guy sold off, let's pretend the following happened. Let's say he sold off his watch because he wanted to get the combs. He got the combs. She used the combs for a week. And then after she had used them for a week, she decided to sell her hair. Or something happened to her hair, or they lost them, or whatever it was. You got benefit from it. At that point, he says, you can no longer back out. I'm skipping a little bit in the interests of time because I want to make sure to spend some good time on the second part of this. But that's another limiting factor. Also, it has to be a loss that was unforeseeable and unpreventable. If it came about because you were careless, you left the cow out in the thunderstorm and it got struck by lightning, so it's your problem. It's not the problem of the seller. That's another limiting factor. More than that, you can only do this if backing out would reset the other person to zero, but would not cause harm. That goes back to Nathan's point. If backing out is actually going to cause harm, you don't have the ability to back out. I brought that in number 9. The Mishnah Lemelech, commenting on Maimonides, on the Rambam, says that that you don't have the ability to back out where you're actually going to harm someone. That's why in the gift case, it's much easier to see backing out, because the other person didn't invest anything. Easy come, easy go. So that's a different story. Also, when you engage in a sale, and this is the point that I had at number 8, when you engage in a sale, there are two parties and two minds involved in the transaction. Right? There's the seller and there's the buyer. It's not so simple for the seller to walk away, because as much as he says the transaction was only under these circumstances, the buyer didn't necessarily think so. As opposed to a gift where it's really one-sided. It's the giver who has to be the one to speak to this. The recipient's mindset doesn't matter. He's just supposed to say thank you. So that's a different dynamic. So for these reasons and more, or, you know, to go back to what Rena said before about land, I didn't bring it on here, but also some of the authorities on this distinguish between gifts of land, because they say people don't normally sell land. That was the assumption historically, unless they need money. You sell movable items to make money. You don't sell your land. To which Rabbi Chil Mechalevstein, the Aruch HaShulchan, writing in Novarduk in the beginning of the 20th century, said that's not necessarily true anymore. People do use land commercially sometimes, and therefore you lose that. But there is, in fact, this argument of maybe land is different as well. The upshot for us, to make a long story shorter rather than longer, is that, no, Jim can't back out. Number one, Jim can't back out because it's not going to be obvious necessarily to the person who sold, to the person who bought his watch, that the reason why Jim sold the watch was to use the money to get combs for his wife because she has beautiful hair. That's number one. Number two, it's not it's not a total loss for him. Hair grows back. One of the points that Della makes within the story. So it may take a while, but keep the combs, and eventually you'll have a use. And then third, and bringing us to the second half of what we have to discuss, there's also an intangible benefit for Jim in all of this. Even if she never uses the combs, it's a thought that counts. She is thrilled that he sold his prized treasure, something that he has as a point of pride. He sold that off in order to get me the combs. I love him. He's wonderful. So that's something that the Jacob, you're in your first year of marriage, so take notes. This is an important idea.
So does that mean there was a benefit?
So yeah, there is a benefit. It's not a total loss for him. Yeah, it's intangible, but nonetheless. So that was on the first half. I don't think he's able to back out. Certainly not within secular law in terms of implied conditions, but I think within Jewish law, the rules that govern when you can back out and when you can't are too strict. But that brings us to altruism and a discussion about what exactly altruism is in the first place. And this requires a discussion of something called the prisoner's dilemma. How many people are familiar with the prisoner's dilemma? Okay, so Prisoner's Dilemma is credited, as you see on your sheet number 10, it's credited to a mathematician, actually from University of Toronto, Albert W. Tucker, in 1950. The idea actually existed before him, but he named it, which, you know, you name it, that's it. But the idea behind the Prisoner's Dilemma is that people whose happiness is, let me start with the dilemma itself. The case of the dilemma first. The case involves two prisoners. They're not yet prisoners. Right now, they're just under investigation. A crime was committed. The claim is, the allegation is, that these two people committed the crime. They are hauled in for interrogation. They're interrogated in separate rooms. And these are the terms which they both know. If neither of you confess, you each are going to spend 2 years behind bars. Forget why, what the legal system is, it doesn't matter. If neither of you confesses, you each get 2 years. If both of you confess, each of you gets 5 years. If one of you confesses and the other does not, the one who confesses is going to get 1 year in jail. The one who doesn't confess is going to get 10 years. Confesses means you say we both did it. So the one who acknowledges we both did it is going to spend a year in jail. The one who says, we didn't do it, is going to be there for 10 years. What are the prisoners going to do? Remember, they're separate rooms, they don't know what the other one did.
And they know the terms of this?
They know the terms. Let's pretend they never met each other until now, and they're never going to see each other again.
They rush the confetti.
It is a utilitarian calculation now. That's the assumption.
They don't know anything to each other.
So what do they do? Right. So the argument of the prisoner's dilemma is that you can predict human behavior using what's called game theory, in which you reduce the decision to the basic pluses and minuses and say, so he's going to choose whatever is best for him. In this case, the prisoners do not trust each other because they have no existing relationship, and they're going to make decisions which are selfish, that's the assumption, and the result is going to be an outcome which is not the best possible outcome. Because what will happen is each one is going to confess, and they're going to spend 5 years in jail. Whereas if they had thought more communally, and they had known that they were each going to think more communally, what would they have chosen? Not to confess. But that requires trust, right? You have to trust that the other guy is going to do that. So that's the prisoner's dilemma. Now, this model was heavily criticized, first of all, because it's simplistic. It reduces human beings to these sort of monochromatic, right, black and white decision makers. And because it assumes utilitarian self-interest, right? People are going to make their decision selfishly.
That's what criminal law is, the exact opposite. They don't confess. They say the other one.
Yeah, I didn't want to get into the legal system.
No, they say the other one did it, not we did it. So nobody's going to confess at all. They're both playing the other side.
Right, so confessing here, right, confessing here means we did it. It doesn't mean it means me.
Yeah, because usually it'll be the other way around. This one will say,
right.
I didn't do it, the other one.
Correct. So there's a professor at, or assistant professor at University of Arizona in 1991, I'm not sure how she pronounces her last name, I think it's Mathiasen, who published many papers on information ethics, intellectual property, access to information, privacy, and she takes on this concern about it, the focus being utilitarian self-interest. And she argues that the prisoner's dilemma isn't really about showing people being selfish. It's just about how you make a decision in a given situation. It's not about being selfish. And she seeks to prove it with what she called the altruist's dilemma. So take a look, flip the page to number 12. 11 was just the explanation of the prisoner's dilemma. We can go to number 12. And she says, I'm going to create for you the altruist's dilemma. Her scenario is the following. There are two students sitting in a classroom. The teacher puts her mug down on the desk, leaves the room. The door slams behind her. The mug falls off the desk and smashes. She comes back into the room and sees the two students sitting there. The students now have to decide, what are we going to do? She says, the following is going to happen. I'm going to interrogate you through recess. If one of you confesses that he did it, if one of them confesses to having done it, then he will pay he'll pay $10 for a new mug. The other one pays nothing, right? And the assumption is the new mug costs $10. If both of you confess to having been involved in destroying the mug, you'll each pay $5. If no one confesses, right, so you lose recess, because I was sitting here questioning you all for recess, but that's it, I can't charge you the $10. However, she said, the students are friends, and they are altruistic, which she defines as, they are happy when someone else is happy. And so the question is, what are they going to do? Knowing that, in the way I framed it in the table on your sheet, knowing that if they confess, the friend doesn't have to pay unless they both confess, in which case the friend pays $5. So what's going to happen? As Mathiasen wrote in number 12, both confess and they each have to pay $5. Right? Because each one says, maybe the other one is going to confess, and I don't want them to have to pay $10, so therefore I'm going to confess also, and therefore we'll pay $5. This is a little bit convoluted, but that's the case, sorry?
Same result.
However, if they had both refrained from confessing, they would have gotten the better outcome, where they both just stay in from recess. That's what Mathiasen says. So you're thinking to yourself at this point, possibly, what in the world does this have to do with the O. Henry story? So take a look at number 13, which is Mathiasen's comment in her eighth footnote in this paper. She says, interestingly, the gift of the Magi, while not a prisoner's dilemma, describes another case where the selfless benevolence of the characters results in a collectively worse-off situation. Just like in the case of their altruists, they want to save the other from paying $10, so they confess in order to save the other one, with the result being that the result is worse. And she says, that's her point about the prisoner's dilemma. She says, it's the same result with altruists, that they don't do what's most efficient, right? Even though their intent is to help. She says the same thing is true in O. Henry's story. The result is a loss for them. You follow? Why?
Because if you heard what you said in the beginning, the interpreter said when she slammed the door, the cop fell. So it's the teacher's fault.
It is the teacher's fault. And the students will keep on yelling that all through recess.
Oh, yeah.
If they deny it.
Finished. That's nothing to discuss. It's your fault. You did it. And that's the end of it. Why is this have to go any further than that?
Right. And they could choose that. But the assumption is that they're making is that they're not... there are flaws in what she wrote in terms of the case that she supposed. And Colin Grant, I'm going to quote number 15, points out what you just pointed out and other problems with it. But I don't want to get bogged down in her circumstances because her key point is the altruism point. And that's the point that's germane for us. Mathiasen says the definition of altruism is I want other people to be happy. And in this case, you actually, in attempting to make other people happy, you will end up losing and coming out with a less good result. That's her verdict. However, O. Henry didn't think they lost. Take a look at number 14 from the ending of the story.
Finding the good there.
Yes, and that's what we're going to come back to.
Using that word of good, bad. Good and bad are very terms that need where we're dealing with monetary loss and objective loss, but that's not necessarily good or bad.
Okay, so how would you choose to define good in this situation?
Oh, I'm not going to go there. I just want to call it
Oh, but no, that's not a problem. That's exactly the question, is how do you define good? What she is assuming, what Mathiasen is assuming, is that the definition of altruistic is that I want somebody else to have a material benefit. I want them to have to pay less, spend less time in jail, whatever it is. Take a look at number 14, where we have O. Henry's conclusion of the story. He says, and here I have lamely related to you the uneventful chronicle of two foolish children in a flat who most unwisely sacrificed for each other the greatest treasures of their house. But in a last word to the wise of these days, let it be said that of all who give gifts, these two were the wisest. Does O. Henry think they lost?
No.
Why not? You sacrifice for each other. There's love in there. There's a relationship. Good is not about whether you have combs for your hair or hair for your combs. Good is about the relationship that you built. There's a fellow by the name of Colin Grant. Colin Grant
accepts this as well. That's why this is the concert.
Exactly. The story wouldn't be popular if we all believed what Mathiasen believes. This is true. Take a look at source number 15. Colin Grant is a Christian ethicist at Mount Allison University in New Brunswick. And he takes Mathiasen to task regarding her definition of altruism. And ultimately our question is going to be, so what's the Jewish definition? But take a look at what he says. By reducing us to selves who have interests in ourselves or in others, game theory furthers the erosion of a sense that we share life. While that reduction may seem to reflect the reality of business and make game theory particularly useful in that context, the weaknesses of game theory the weaknesses of game theory in its inability to account for cooperation signals precisely the danger of relying on this theory in understanding business. If business can only rely on the trust it can wring out of mistrust, so much the worse for business, not to mention the wider society. In other words, what he says is, you better hope your business relationships are not based on this kind of game theory calculation. That everybody involved in a transaction is going to decide based on a utilitarian calculation of what is in their personal interest. He says, we don't want a society that is like that. We want a society that values the interests of others and the trust that you create. And in number 16, he writes it, he defines altruism as oblivious to the otherness of the others as to the interests of the self. You don't look at it as me and you. There are no barriers between your own existence and those of others.
This is interesting. This kind of thinking comes into play with tax planning lately, with a lot of major corporations like Google and some of the other major corporations have structured themselves to avoid tax in various jurisdictions. And Starbucks, for example, in the UK. Now, there's a lot being written and a lot of steps being taken by some of these corporations to voluntarily pay tax where they don't have to.
Right.
And write the check because they found that the negative publicity, Starbucks found the negative publicity of being found out that they paid so little tax in the UK, for example, was bad for morale and bad for business.
Right.
So it's kind of a more indirect thing, but it's not all based on dollars and cents.
Right.
It's more of a long-term sort of a trust relationship.
Right, and I actually just read an article yesterday about the aftermath of the Panama Papers, talking about how people who suddenly discovered that their tax avoidance, while legal, is unpopular, and not only that, but can be made public, have decided to go a different route and are indeed restructuring, so to speak. I read a book a while back, the founders of Ben & Jerry's, when they created their whole social justice mission for their company, founded it on this idea that they... That trying to do the best for themselves is not necessarily what's going to be best for their company. Now, they're arguing more lishma. You know, as purely altruistic, this is what we are supposed to try to do, is to help others and so forth, and that's the goal of our corporation, as opposed to the utilitarian calculation of people aren't going to like us when they find out that we're not paying taxes. But either way, these are two different versions of altruism. Version one of altruism, the Matthiasen version of altruism, is that I think about you being happy in a utilitarian sense, and I'm going to act in a way that's going to make sure that you will be happy to the extent that I can, and the result may be good, may not be good. I'll make a sacrifice, right. The other way to look at it is this more global perspective of, it's not you versus me, it's we are all one, and what I'm looking for is building up the collective with the relationships that go into it. So the question is, what would we say from a Jewish business ethics perspective? Would we take the narrow goal of being happy when others are happy? Would we look to merge with others? So, you know, we could actually spend, you know, hours and hours on this, but I wanted to show you one source, which I think captures very nicely a Jewish position on it. Take a look at number 17. It's a Mishnah in Pirkei Avos. Pirkei Avot. They're describing four different approaches towards property. And it says the following. Person who says, what's mine is yours, and what's yours is mine, is called in the Hebrew Am Haaretz. It's a trait of ignorance. What's mine is yours. What's yours is mine. That's no good. What's mine is yours. And what's yours... Oh, you know what? I was not careful in my translation. Sorry. What's mine is yours, and what's yours, is what it should say, is piety. That's a trait of piety. If you say what's mine is yours, and what's yours, that is a good thing. Rabbeinu Yonah is a classic commentator to Pirkei Avot, among other things, and he explained, if you say what's mine is yours and what's yours is mine, that's ignorant, and he asks, because he desires to improve the world, he's called ignorant. What's wrong with that? He wishes to take and give, increasing love between them. That's a good thing. But he says, although this is a good trait for improving the world, it is unwise, for one who hates gifts will live. He says, it's great to say what's mine is yours. It's not so great to say what's yours is mine. Because then you're making the decision for the other guy and saying, I think I should have access to your property too. It's okay. Right. Yes. It's okay for me to blur the lines and say we are all one when it comes to sharing mine with you. But I can't impose that on somebody else. He says the best trade is to give and not take, which is the pious trait that it concludes with. That's Rabbeinu Yonah's approach. He says we see an advantage in building up the world for others, but not in terms of taking. So that Judaism really, I think, presents a third way. Not the Matthiasen utilitarian, I am happy when you gain, in which it's really each one out for himself, but I'm going to be happy if you're going to gain something. But also not the open merger where there are no boundaries, where there is no wall between myself and the other, as Colin Grant presents as Christian altruism. It's a philosophy of merger, but with a recognition that merging has clear limits. And I brought you two sources to illustrate the application. On the one hand, in source number 18, we deal with the case of redeeming hostages. People are taken hostage. The kidnappers demand a ransom. They demand an exorbitant sum, more than this person would go for on the slave market, which is sort of the standard for evaluation. Do we pay the ransom? And the Mishnah says in source number 18, you do not. Why? Because of repair of the world. What does that mean? The Talmud brings two possible explanations. Either because you're going to overburden the community to pay this, or because you're going to give them an incentive to kidnap more people in the future. If I believed that there are no boundaries between myself and others, it would be, I don't care about the burden on the community. Just pay it. We place a limit on that. We say, don't go that far. On the other hand, we do have a concept of redeeming them in the first place. The fact that we declare an imperative to redeem them, which Maimonides describes as the highest form of tzedakah, charity, the fact that we do have a value of redeeming in the first place tells me we do blur the boundaries to the extent that we say we want to redeem, we just draw a line. Similarly, in source number 19, the classic debate about two people who are traveling and they have one pitcher of water, which one of them is holding. And they magically know that if they both drink, they're not going to get to safety. But if one of them drinks, he'll survive and the other one will die. How do they know it? This is the case. And Rabbi Akiva makes the statement, which we accept as law, that your life precedes that of your brother. Your own life comes first. So once again, you see, there is a boundary. There is still a limit. There's more to be said about each of these cases. But what I want to do is just to sum up quickly and say, we first explored the question of whether a person can back out of a transaction. Can Jim back out of the sale of his watch? And we said you can back out within Jewish business ethics. Secular law will say, forget it, you can't back out. But Jewish business ethics will say, you can back out only if the contingency that was involved is obvious or stated explicitly at the time of the transaction, and the loss is abnormal, total, unforeseeable, and unpreventable. It wasn't you were careless, and backing out is not going to harm the other party. Otherwise, you wouldn't be able to do it. So there's a limited ability to back out, but very limited. And then in the second half, we explored the question of what this teaches us about altruism as a value, and said that if altruism is about a calculation of, I am happy when you gain, then Jim and Della both lost, because gain becomes a very utilitarian calculation. If, however, altruism is about merging with others and community and trust and affection and that sort of thing, then Grant is correct that Jim and Della won. Because who cares about the Combs? What they gained in their relationship is much stronger. Pirkei Avot, what we brought at the end here in the last three sources, I think tends more towards the view that we are merging with others by saying you should be willing to say what's mine is yours. But it does impose certain limits and say that the limit is you can do that when you give to others. You cannot make the demand that others do that for you. There's much more to say. I think it just from the last 50 minutes, I've learned a little bit more about trying to do this from a story and what works or doesn't work. I want to make sure to let you know that next week, Rabbi Ziering, the Sgan from our Beit Midrash, is going to speak on the story of the necklace. And then the week after that, I will be speaking on Those Who Walk Away from Omelas, which is, I think, probably the least familiar story in the bunch, but you can find it online. I'll be sending out a link in advance. And then the last session, Rabbi Ziering will speak on The Merchant of Venice. So those are the sessions coming up. I will stay around to answer questions and discuss further, but because I know people are on a clock, I don't want to hold everybody for the question and discussion. So if anyone has to go, feel free to do so. And there could probably be a group or cut on his own as well, based on... Sorry? Yes, I hope so. Right. So Mark says that if you're good to God and good to others, that's a reasonable definition of good. I think there's definitely something to be said for it. So I'm going to take questions, but those who have to go can...